a little bit of a froggy voice this morning, but better than yesterday. I didn't have any voice yesterday, so. Well, this morning, I think what I'd like to talk about is last Wednesday at our group discussion, a study group, we've been looking at Tenzo Kyokan of Dogen Zenji, Instructions to the Cook, and the original, this is Uchiyama Roshi's translation and his commentaries, and when that was originally published, he published it under the title Refining Your Life, which I really like, and it is about refining your life. Zen practice is about refining your life. And this is Zen practice, refining your life. But I don't know that we so readily appreciate that or understand that. And but Dogen really makes this clear, I think, in the Tenzo Kyokan as well as elsewhere. And we came upon a very interesting passage last Wednesday that I felt, first of all, I felt that we didn't really get into it as completely as we perhaps we could have. That was my doing. And also there's aspects of it that I think, you know, more people need to hear about. And so for that reason, I want to discuss that this morning. It's a story that Dogen was telling. Dogen, by the way, I should say for those of you who don't know, was a great Japanese Zen master in our lineage, in the Soto lineage. He brought the Soto Zen to Japan from China in the early 13th century. And some people think that he brought Zen or even Buddhism to China, to Japan. That's not true, just a Soto Zen. And a great teacher in our lineage. He went to China to study as a young man. And in the Tenzo Kyokan, there are several stories of encounters he had with great teachers in China, particularly the Tenzos. And while he was still on board ship shortly after arriving in China, the Tenzo from a nearby monastery, well, it's about 14 miles away. He came on foot, so not exactly nearby, I guess. But the Tenzo, the cook, the head cook from this monastery, came to buy some mushrooms. And Dogen began to talk with this senior monk, a very learned fellow in his late 60s, and was very taken by this, and he wanted him to stay after he had purchased his mushrooms. Dogen asked him to stay. You want to talk to him some more? Can't you stay overnight? No. He had to get back. And Dogen began to ask him questions like, well, why at your age, you know, should you work so hard, you know, at being a Tenzo? And why can't you spend your time doing Zazen, you know, meditation and studying the koans, he said. Well, Dogen was plying him with questions like this when the old monk just burst out laughing. He said, my young, how do you put it now, my young friend from abroad, he said, at least in the translation we have, my young friend from abroad, he says, you do not yet understand the practice or the meaning of the characters, literally just meaning the Chinese characters. But what he's really saying is you don't understand this practice, and you don't understand life, reality, phenomena. You don't understand what's going on, basically what he's saying. But he did this in a very congenial way, I suspect. And Dogen felt embarrassed, ashamed of himself for this. But wanted to know, well, what is this practice then? What is, because all I was asking was, why don't you do more Zazen? Why don't you spend your time in Zazen and studying the koans? Why work so hard as a Tenzo? Well, of course, these are very common questions that we have. And it's very interesting that one who ultimately achieves such profound understanding and realization as Dogen, here as a young person, still not fully steeped in this practice yet and in this way, had this very ordinary understanding of what he was doing and what this practice is about, what Zen is about. And so I think this is very important for us, because I think we all approach Zen in very much this way. Maybe we're going to get something out of this. Certainly, why would we spend our time in meditation if that weren't the case? Why can't we do something more constructive, more productive, like sit in meditation, rather than working so hard? You can get someone else to do these things. Well, somehow we tend to do this. We separate our practice and what we think this practice is from ordinary life, everyday life, the life of, taking care of things, preparing meals, and what have you. We do this so easily, and we think that we're doing something special when we engage in this practice, something separate and apart from what we ordinarily do. And to the extent that we have this idea, this notion, our practice is still not mature, and we are living in a kind of a separation from our actual life. Not because we really are. How could we do that? But in our mind, we are. In our minds, we pull ourselves out from the activity, from life. We look at it from afar, so to speak, and then we try to get something from that. This is a very subtle point. We reach into that so easily, or fall into that, I should say, so easily. Even in our discussion the other night, we kept falling back into this ordinary way of thinking. Why do we practice? Well, then we have to come up with reasons for why we practice. To preserve, I think one of the responses was to preserve the Four Noble Truths. Well, we don't need to preserve the Four Noble Truths. To the extent that these truths are truths, they don't need preserving, certainly not by us. On the other hand, to the extent that they are not, if they are not, in other words, the ideas and constructions we make in our own minds about such things, well, first of all, you can't preserve anything like that, and you'll only frustrate yourself trying. You might, once again, set yourself off from others and maybe get into arguments and fights, taking different standpoints and arguing back and forth. And why? Where do we think we're going with this? There's another story of Dogen. When I was thinking about talking about this, I realized another story is in the back of my mind. Katagiri Roshi, my teacher, used to tell this story, but I couldn't remember where it was from. So if I poked around in a few sources where I thought it might be, and I couldn't find it. And so I always call my Dharma brother Norm. Most of you, I think, know Norm, who is just a wealth of, for me, a real resource of understanding about Dogen. He knows Dogen far better than I. And invariably, if I ask Norm, where is this, he'll find it. If he doesn't have it right on the top of his head, at the tip of his fingers or whatever, he'll come up with it for me. Oh, yeah, Katagiri used to tell that story. I said, yeah, but where did he get it from? And he said, well, I don't know. And I was telling him where I thought it might be. And, yeah, well, anyway, he says, well, I'll see if I can find it. I said, well, don't spend too much time with it. Well, sure enough, he did. 2 hours later, I get a call back, he'd been digging all that time, but he found it. And of course, I try to thank him. You can't do that with Norm. No, he ends up thanking me, because with all of this digging around, he came up with some new ideas for talks and things he might want to explore in the future. So there's Norm. Well, anyway, big heart. But he found it. It was actually, where is it? Well, it's in Katagiri Roshi's first book, Returning to Silence. And of course, it isn't sourced. Katagiri never sourced his material. He just would tell his story. Well, there it is. So right back to where I was. It was a story that told by my teacher, Katagiri Roshi. But he would tell this story. I still don't know really where it's from, but at least now I do have a source. It's my teacher told me it's in this book. But the story of Dogen, again, very similar to the one we heard. And we were thinking that it might have been a conversation he had with Ru Jing, his Dogen's teacher in China. Katagiri said it was a teacher saw Dogen one day studying the scriptures and asked him, well, what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm studying the scriptures. And he said, teacher said, well, what for? And he said, so that I can learn the ways of the masters. And he said, well, what for? Well, so that I can relieve my suffering. Well, what for? Well, so that maybe I can, help others with their suffering. Well, what for? Well, when I go back to Japan, maybe I can help the people in the village. What for? And finally, Dogen was brought to silence. Couldn't respond. And if we look very carefully, at our lives and how we construct things for ourselves within our minds, justifying this or justifying that, why we do this and why we do that, if you continuously ask, well, why? Why are you doing this? Of course, we get nowhere. Very often, though, for us in our confusion, we think that why is a pretty important question. Why this, why that? And we go searching for answers to this. But if you were if you pursue that openly and honestly, you never really arrive at anything. Because what we started from was something that we posited, some idea and notion that we have about life, about reality. We begin with this, and we ask why about it. Sooner or later, we get into all kinds of, but we don't find any substance behind what is going on there. In Zen, the question isn't why, because again, you could just keep offering reasons why, and you don't get anywhere. No, in Zen, the question then is what. Not that you really get anywhere with this one either, except with what you can come to realize that it's just this. And again, any time you supply an answer, any time you try to plug something in there, it might be useful, might be good, helpful. It's not that we shouldn't do this. We have to do this. We do this. But we make the mistake of thinking somehow I can figure it all out this way. I can make sense of my life. This is the structure of it. This is how it should be. And this is what Zazen is for. It's for me to gain something. Always our life is left in fragments, and I'm sitting here and there's these other things out here that I need something from, that it must be this way. I try to offer some explanation for this or that. But if we look very carefully at all of this, and we get so emotionally bound up with this, we fight wars and just petty arguments with our fellow human beings about such issues like this. All the while thinking that what it is that we've captured here, what it is that we've gotten a grip on, is something in particular, and that it has something to do with reality ultimately. No, it's just a temporary thing that we're passing through. Zen practice then is not about something like that. Well, if I do this, then I can get that. It is not about it. It is finally to come to the realization that it just simply doesn't work this way. Life, reality. It is just simply that we need to settle down. This is what the practice, just settle down right into the unfolding of life itself. Temporarily, maybe we need to grasp this to hold this up, whatever, but then we can let it go again. In the idea that we need to preserve the Four Noble Truths through our practice, something like this. Well, if that were the case, then why did the Buddha explain these Four Noble Truths as a raft, something that we temporarily use and then release, let go? It is because reality is to be found in the dynamic of this moment. And this is what our practice is about. But this is a very, very, very subtle point. And at some point along the way, we need to start to recognize within ourselves this grasping mind, this intentional mind of ours, to put something in an encapsulated form, to put some kind of a label on it, something we can identify, something that we need to grip and to hold on to. Again, we have these structures in our life and in our minds, and this is all fine. But the error we make is that we mistake these things for reality, and we hold them a little too dearly, and we drag them into all kinds of conflict and confusion with us as we live our life. So this practice, and as Dogen is speaking of it, this refining your life is refining it in this way to realize what it is that we're doing, to settle down into this moment and to take care of it completely and totally and without justification. You know, why do you do this? It makes it all very difficult. And I remember in my own the exact moment, really, in my own practice as a young person, like everyone else, approaching it in the usual way to get something. I remember the moment when I suddenly realized what I was doing and I stopped. It's not like I intentionally stopped, it just sort of fell off. I had no reason, nothing to justify this practice and why to do it. I still don't to this day. We talk about this. My teacher used to point this out. It's kind of like we don't believe it, though. Well, surely you must have, there must be, you know, some reason for you to do this. Well, there are reasons for me to do all kinds of things, but not to be here in the world. And there's no way to explain that or justify it. It is a matter of just learning to step into that and to take care of that and to realize what it is that I am doing when I grasp something, when I hold something up, when I find myself getting into conflict with others, etc. This is what we need to do. So this practice then is just simply to step into this moment. For no reason. You are already here in this moment for no reason. Why make up an explanation now? It only entangles our life, confuses our life, sets us up for conflict and disappointment. You know, the things that we do grasp and hold to, we can hold on to them with a loosened grip, with a light touch. And enjoy our lives, to not be baffled by our lives, to live them completely, wholly, fully in the moment. This is refining our life. So, you know, if you get up every morning for meditation, whatever your practice might be, if you have some ideas, somebody asks you, well, why do you do this practice? I remember I used to offer explanations. Of course, anybody can just say, well, like Dogen's teacher, what for? And you're going to lose. You will lose. Realize in the maturing of our practice that ultimately you can't offer an explanation. You don't need one. And quite honestly, I mentioned this, I think, the other night, but I don't have any notion or idea or explanation or justification for why I practice. Long ago, that just fell away. And any kinds of difficulties and struggles we might have with our practice falls away with it. And it isn't like my practice is something I do when I come to this room. No, it is something that we need to realize in each moment of our life. And I certainly haven't mastered that, but it's a wonderful thing to, in each moment, just to bring yourself back to what is actually taking place. There's real joy and freedom in that. Well, I think I mentioned all the points I wanted to make about that. Any questions or... Yes.
Sure, instead of Robert. But you just said you're trying to master staying present in the moment as much as you can day to day, in every moment of your life. Is that something that is part of the practice, just getting better at that?
Well, no. You see, there, once again, just to show the subtlety of this, there's grasping again. Yeah, and another thing my teacher used to talk about, you know, people ask, well, you know, how am I doing, you know? Or they'd ask him, how are you doing as a Zen teacher, you know? How many people have you helped? Well, what, has he got a scorecard somewhere, you know? And he said, that's not my business. You know, how we're doing, how we're refining it, how we're getting along, this is not our business. You make that your business immediately, you put your mind back into this fractured world that we tend to construct for ourselves, and then we try to see how we're doing here. All the while we're doing this, we're not... here, just get back into this moment. And It isn't a matter of trying to do it or trying to get anything from it. But see, once again, this is how we commonly think. So right away, we cast it back in those terms. At some point, we have to realize, we have to catch ourselves in the act of doing this. Realize that we're doing this. And see the suffering and the confusion that goes along with it. And recognize that you never get to the bottom of it. You will never come up with the final explanation or justification for this or that. That is why what this practice is the very heart of being free of that kind of bondage, which is just simply a bondage within our own mind, restrictions that we, you know, put on ourselves, you know, ways in which we bind ourselves. Anything else? Oh, yes, Hank.
I've heard it said that a why question is a question about trying to control things. Does that fit with what you're saying? That sort of the effort that we're making in this is we're always looking to control.
Yeah.
Whether out of liking or loathing or whatever I want to. Mm-hmm. And that freedom comes from not trying to control things anymore.
Yeah. I think that's a strong element there. Yeah. But also the why is coming out of a presumption on our part that there has to be an explanation ultimately. You know, well, there's these only attach themselves to or are there within our intentional world, our intentional mind, that we put something here for a reason. You know, maybe we said this for some reason. Not always, though, of course. But it's always appearing in that kind of a context. But when it comes to reality, well, you know, you've probably heard that old question of, you know, why is a mouse? You know, it doesn't apply. You know, that's not the kind of question, you know, that makes any sense or that's meaningful or helpful. And of course, what this practice and activity that we do is about is finally learning to see past the confusion that we create for ourselves, you know, in trying to explain our situation, our behavior, our this or that, or what we want out of life, etc., to come up with stories to support all of this, see through all of that, and to realize that we're doing this, and all of that construction is just riddled with these, why things, and we pursue those, you just remain caught in the entanglements. And like in the case of Dogen, or Rujing asking Dogen, if that's who it was, asking, finally Dogen gets to this point where there's nothing to say. Another point I should make about that, or something I meant to say earlier actually, we could make the mistake then of thinking, well, there's nothing to say. So then it's like, well, life is just, well, you know, anything goes kind of thing. And some people interpret Zen in this way. That's not really what that means. It isn't just anything goes. Just because we can't finally supply that last why justification, because our lives would be very very messy, very difficult, very confused. Now this is about refining our lives, bringing yourself back to what is actually happening, going on here. Why? You don't need to ask that question. You know, just do it. A few weeks ago, I gave a talk on in this matter of enlightenment is when a person is when we're awake, the mind isn't focused on any particular point here. But when we're deluded, that's it. We're fixed on this or that or things in relation to each other. But we're not. We're oblivious to this this kind of general awareness, which is where the enlightenment is, the awakening is. You will never make that into something, and don't even try. But what we need to do is to sensitize ourselves to that, and then look at where we are dealing with this against that, etc. See to it that we have a magnanimous mind, a just mind, etc. Whether you're dealing with your own kids or, you know, just life in general. Of course, life is complicated. But if we can spot that gripping hand within our own mind, that insisting hand, we can really clarify an awful lot of painful issues and a lot of confusion. Anything else out there?
protection. Siddhartha went out into the city and saw suffering.
Mm-hmm.
Had Siddhartha not asked why, what would Shakyamuni have had to teach?
If he had not asked why?
Yes.
Why is there suffering? Yeah. Well,
My statement here is that why is as valid as what? Because they are the same problem. Both why and what are answered and questioned in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the middle way is going to be finding the dichotomy or the disparity between question and answer.
Yeah.
And
well,
both why and what are equal to that test.
I think, again, you'll find why very much wrapped up with our intentional mind.
Irrelevant.
Huh?
Irrelevant. They come to
no, but well, let me finish. You know, but the other question too. I didn't finish the matter of what, but we don't answer the what question either. And the why question, it's not that we shouldn't ask a why question. We can go ahead and ask a why question. That's what Ru Jing was asking of Dogen. Well, why? What for? Why do that? And very quickly though, we'll come to this mind of ours that's trying to justify, trying to explain, trying to offer something, when in fact the universe doesn't offer you any justification at all. Nevertheless, there is this immediate situation that we're in, where there's pain, there's suffering, there's confusion, and we're not looking at it. We're not dealing with it because we're turning our mind to the constructed reality of the storyline of our life. And feeling that somehow we need to patch that up to make it fit reality. It won't fit reality. There's no way you'll get it to fit reality. Even the question of what, we finally never settle down on what it is, but what we wake up to is here it is. It's right here. With why, you're less likely to, you could still arrive in the same place with why, but it's much more easy to be caught up because we're concerned with justification with this why question, and that keeps us more tightly bound up in there. But with what, not so much.
I think we need to be caught up in both.
Yeah, well, maybe so. But it's not so much the getting caught, of course, is the problem. But the why is, I think if you look at that carefully, why is more confined to the artificial world, the synthetic world of our own making. Whereas what seems to bring us out into a larger sphere. That's all. But both those questions can bring you to a point where finally, as Kagiri would say, we just shut up. Sit down. Don't offer some justification. Yeah, Gary?
Isn't there a motivation to be free of bondage? Bindage, or however you'd say.
Bondage? I'm sorry, I missed
you. Well, you mentioned that when we're caught up with the whys or motivation, trying to solve things, mm-hmm. trying to get things, all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
That we're bound. Some people actually like that, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They want to be really immersed in life.
Right.
Really feel it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we say, no, it's better to be free of that. And I'm saying,
why? I don't know that I would say it's better to be free of that. Just see it for what it is. And would you ever intentionally step into that? I mean, the Buddha tells a story very much to that point where about how we like to get caught up in things that are actually painful, sorrowful, and confusing for us, even though we don't, because we think we're getting pleasure out of it. He tells a story of this. I don't think that you actually experience this if you have leprosy, but it's about a leper who found some comfort by standing near hot coals. And so he would stand near these hot coals, and it would relieve his pain, his suffering. Well, then later on, somehow, miraculously, his leprosy was cured, and he wandered away from this area where he was with other lepers who had this practice of standing near these fire pits, and kind of lived an ordinary life. And he was back in the same area where these lepers were, and he went back to the place where they were standing near these fire pits, the lepers, you see. but he couldn't approach. He couldn't approach because now he realized, you know, the pain. So what the Buddha is saying is that in our confusion, we think we're finding pleasure here. Something is soothing to us, you know, but when we're whole again, you know, when we're not confused, we're not caught up in that, that which we find pleasure in when we're confused is not pleasurable at all to us. So the fact that people do want to jump into and wallow in all of these things that seem fun and exciting and good and all of that, sure. Yeah, I understand that. But how often do we find the person who, after, you know, I was telling the story of Lonzo de Vasto, the fellow who's he was a kind of a playboy and rich and handsome and money and all of that, and he was racing around in his sports cars and things, and he ends up in India, robbed the first day he lands there off the boat. It was back in the 30s, and all of his money, passports, identification, everything is taken from him, you know. And he goes on quite an adventure, ends up becoming a disciple of Gandhi. And well, here's a guy who was living, you know, the high life by any standards, you know, thinking that was a lot of fun. Well, you should see what he has to say about that. I quoted him where he said that pleasure itself teaches us this is not what we should seek. He said, because as you chase after pleasure, and pleasure just recedes, it flees. But you turn away from pleasure, pleasure will seize you and not let go. But it's a different kind of pleasure. It's a different kind of happiness and contentment and peace of mind. And there's great subtlety to this, and we can easily miss it. Most of us do for a fairly substantial time within our lives generally. Maybe most miss it all the way up to the last stinging moment of our life. But we don't need to.
Being free of that's a motivation too.
Being free of it isn't a motivation. Thinking you have to be free of it is a motivation. Thinking that enlightenment is better than being deluded, that's having a motivation. But we don't talk in those terms. You know, we don't say that enlightenment is better than delusion, that delusion is bad. We keep thinking this. I teach this repeatedly, and still people don't pick up on it. That delusion is not bad. Enlightenment is not good. Enlightenment is not better than delusion. These two are inseparable from each other.
Well, that guy running around in the sports car, that didn't sound very good.
Well, you see, at one point we could say, well, he's probably having a lot of fun. Look at that guy, you know. But he himself grew and developed and changed in such a way that near the end of his life, he would have never returned to that kind of life. Well, what's going on here? We should ask ourselves that question. What is it that you think you're going to get out of it, too? And as we define different things in our life, well, what's pleasurable and what isn't? I think I told a story somewhere recently of a fellow I knew who defined work as not having fun. Going to a party is fun. And so I used to work with this guy, and he was miserable on the job all the time, always actually trying to have a party on the job. Finally got fired. But this is just something he's creating in his head. Okay? And chasing back after that and trying to arrange the world to fit it. Well, the world, in that case, didn't comply. And really, it never will. But these are the structures that we create within our own mind, and then we insist it's got to be like this or like that, and and then we frustrate ourselves and get angry and upset. And is that bad? No, it is what it is. Just see it for what it is. What it is. We don't need to call that bad. And what's enlightenment? Enlightenment is that you see that for what it is, and you don't get caught. It's a very simplistic way of looking at that, but it'll do for now, I guess. And that's all that is. It doesn't mean that it's better.
It's
free. We can be free of that. But how are we free of that? We are free of that by seeing it. Really seeing it deeply. And in each action and movement that we take and thought that we have, we catch ourselves once again as we go reaching for this or that. Tom, you had something?
Thinking about the sports car, and the sports car could be doing sashins, And if you're chasing after that and looking for results, you would be the same
exactly.
as a sports car.
Yes.
Now, why do you do a session? An often question can come up to your mind. I think you just do it, but underneath that, there's a full, whatever the practice, there's some type of fullness that develops.
And no, don't.
Don't
go any further than that.
It's just like being in a moment.
Don't you see, Tom?
You can't chase after it. I'm not saying
Tom, don't you see it's the same game?
Yeah, it's a little more subtle.
It's more subtle, but it's the same
I just
game.
It's
the same game. And we have to realize that, you know, this thoroughly. And there's no justification in the end.
I didn't say there was any justification. Didn't even mean to imply there was justification.
Yeah.
But there's some reason you're just doing, but again,
no.
Human would come back to the same or something.
Well, here we go. I mean, you can say yes, it is, and I could say no, it's not. And you say yes, it is, and no, it's not. But I think I've said enough already. Yeah.
No more sports.
Yes.
I'm concerned now about thousands of sports cars. On the back of the tape, I took a Han tape on the back of the box that said, do not practice meditation while riding a vehicle.
Well, but I would say to that, I'd say yes and no. Because the meditation is really just to be there. You have to fold yourself up on a cross-legged position. Yeah, you're right. But then we should realize that meditation is what? It's just a practice of being here. And I think you can do that behind the wheel. In fact, I think you better. I think we've gone kind of long here. I better end it. Thank you.